Eric Reese writes in his new book, Lost Mountain, that many Eastern Kentucky residents don't believe Neil Armstrong walked on the moon. That's because the land left behind by radical strip mine operations looks so moon-like. The locals joke that NASA could have filmed an astronaut walking around their area. Lost Mountain is published by Riverhead Books, and I'm pleased that it brings Eric Reese to my show today. Hello.
Hello.
So how much does strip mine land really look like a lunar landscape?
It looks a lot like one. What happens is they begin with an intact mountain, and they shave off all of the trees and burn the trees, and then they start setting off blasts similar to the ones Timothy McVeigh set off in Oklahoma City, and they slowly just start bulldozing about 200 feet of the summit over into the valley, into what they call valley fills, which, of course, bury thousands of miles of streams. And so what you end up with when all the blasting is through is a grayish, brownish landscape that has no vegetation on it.
Could they have carted that stuff away?
They could have, but under the current administration, they're allowed to do the cheapest thing possible in terms of extracting the minerals. There's bills that come up every year in the Kentucky legislature to make them cart off the rubble or return at least the topsoil to the mountaintops, but they don't do it.
When did you first see something like this?
It was about 5 years ago. I was taking students down to Eastern Kentucky for a nature writing class.
But didn't you grow up in the area and have your own personal relationship with coal mining?
My personal relationship with coal mining is my father was a mechanical engineer in Louisville, and so he worked at a coal-fired power plant there. His grandmother lived in Hazard, Kentucky, and we would go to visit her when I was a kid. But as I grew up, I went back less and less. So it was really 5 years ago that I started going back intensely and started to see how this very diverse ecosystem was being ruined.
Well, we know about strip mining. How does this differ from what we've heard about strip mining in the past?
It differs in that it's just a much more extreme version of it. When contour mining was done, that was the kind of strip mining that was done in the 60s and 70s. That was bad. It caused erosion. It ruined creeks. But with this kind of mining, they literally blast off the entire mountaintop. And so you just have nothing left. You just have a desert.
And that's why you've called this book Lost Mountain, a mountain that was a mountain now that is no longer one?
That's right. When I started thinking about writing about this, my editor, John Sullivan at Harper's, said, what if you just followed one mountain from the beginning to the end and described how it was destroyed? And so I went to the permit room in Frankfort in Kentucky and looked to see which mountains were about to be permitted for mining, and I found a permit that said there was this mountain in Perry County called Lost Mountain.
How could you
ignore that? I saw the metaphorical value in that. So.
Well, is this something that is done everywhere now, or is this something that might be done in West Virginia as well, or are they still mining the old-fashioned way?
They are mining the old-fashioned way, as the Sago tragedy shows, but because you can get so much more coal so much faster with mountaintop removal, that's their preferred method. So they're doing it extensively in West Virginia, Kentucky, northeastern Tennessee, and Virginia.
Well, is it safer for miners?
It's safer for miners in the sense that they're not going to get black lung. It's safer for miners.
And they're also not going to be trapped in there, are they?
No, they're not going to be trapped. It's not safe for the people who live around the mountains because they're suffering. Their water is toxic. They can't bathe their children in clean water. The blasting from the mine sites is ruining their wells. It's shaking the foundation of their houses and chimneys. And the coal dust that it generates is unbelievable. I mean, little old ladies have to mow their grass wearing respirators because of all the coal dust that it generates.
I want to come back to that, but I was wondering whether the coal industry is under increased pressure now to produce more coal because of concerns about the oil supply.
They are. Anytime the price of oil goes up, the price of coal goes up, and the price per ton of coal has doubled in the year it took me to write this book. And so the mountaintop removal is quickening. The pace of it is quickening.
How is coal most commonly used these days?
coal-fired power plants.
So it's most of our electricity is coming from coal-fired power
51% of it is. Over 1 billion tons of coal were burnt last year.
Mm-hmm. And the alternatives are water power, hydropower, and then still a little bit of the nuclear power.
And solar and wind.
Uh-huh. Do we get much of that?
We could. There are studies that show that we could work on a 10-20-30 model whereby 2010 we would have 10% alternative energy by 2020, 20% so on out.
So are those energy concerns putting pressure on places like Kentucky and the local governments not to interfere with these coal mining techniques, even if it's destroying areas?
West Virginia and Kentucky legislators are bought and sold by the coal industry. So, yes, there's enormous pressure, and that's the reason that you can't get bills through the state legislature because there's so much corporate power.
And they give a lot of money to politicians. You say Senator Mitch McConnell has really been richly rewarded, but also President Bush. And you say that the coal industry has given Republicans $8.5 million in the last 6 years. 91% of the industry's contributions are made to Republicans. Aren't there Democrats that represent coal mining areas as well?
Yes, there are, especially at the state level.
But they're not getting the money?
No, they're not getting the money that the Republicans are getting.
Do you have any idea why? Is it a matter of who supports the policies that this industry sees is best for them?
Let me give you an example that goes back to the Sago tragedy. Bush in 2000 appointed Dave Lurisky as the head of the Mine Safety and Health Administration. Lurisky came straight out of the coal industry and out of lobbying for the coal industry. He did everything in his power to gut MSHA and to make sure that anybody at MSHA who did try to enforce the law was transferred away from their home to other districts. So there is a direct link between the death of the miners in West Virginia and the lax enforcement at MSHA. And that is connected to the fact that 90% of coal contributions go to Republicans.
My guest is Eric Reese, E-R-I-K-R-E-E-C-E, who teaches writing at the University of Kentucky in Lexington and whose work has appeared in Harper's, Orion, and the Oxford American, among other publications. In fact, he wrote a story for Harper's that Lost Mountain is based on. Lost Mountain, A Year in the Vanishing Wilderness, Radical Strip Mining, and the Devastation of Appalachia, published by Riverhead Books. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. What laws are on the books right now that would regulate this sort of mining?
There really aren't any. Judge Hayden in West Virginia tried to pass a law that would not allow coal operators to dump into valley fills, and that basically would have stopped mountaintop removal.
But isn't there a law that goes back to 1977, the Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, that requires companies to restore, I'm quoting, the approximate contour of the sites they've strip mined?
Or there's a variance there that says if they can leave it at a higher or better use, then they don't have to restore it. And that loophole has been devastating because higher and better use has been interpreted to mean anything from, quote, wildlife refuge to pasture. And so what happens, like what happened on Lost Mountain, is instead of returning the sandstone, the topsoil to the mountain and reforesting that with hardwoods, they simply planted an exotic grass, called it a pasture, and moved on.
Well, aren't the mining companies required to post a bond that they'll forfeit if they don't restore the mine sites? Is that ever enforced?
I talked to people at the Office of Surface Mining who would lose their jobs if I named them, who told me that the bond money is never enough to really reclaim the sites. And so what happens is a lot of the coal companies simply give up their bond, declare bankruptcy, and start a new coal company somewhere else.
So they set up a shell company?
They set up a shell.
Does the government use the forfeited bond money to restore the sites?
in Kentucky and West Virginia, there are so many sites like this that there simply isn't, there aren't enough people on the state level to do the jobs.
Doesn't mining provide a lot of jobs for Kentucky residents? Does the mountaintop removal mining technique provide as many jobs as conventional mining did?
It doesn't provide near as many jobs as conventional mining. What's happened in the mining industry over the last 50 years is that it's become so highly mechanized, the equipment is so large, and the explosives are so powerful that literally 10 men can completely annihilate a mountain and extract the coal and move on. So the jobs argument is it does hold some weight for underground mining. But as we've seen, the underground mining is so dangerous, and the above ground mining, there are no jobs in it.
Coal-related employment in Kentucky has dropped by 60% in the last 15 years.
That's right.
Has Eastern Kentucky been an easy target for radical strip mining because it's so poor?
That's right. It's rich in resources, and what has happened is coal barons, who are almost all absentee landlords, such as Peabody Coal in St. Louis, Massey Energy in Richmond, Virginia, Tampa Energy in Tampa, these are huge operations who've come into Eastern Kentucky and West Virginia, into Central Appalachia, and they have taken all the resources and have returned nothing to the people. The people are left with poison water, broken foundations, flash flooding, mudslides.
Isn't this the area that Lyndon Johnson visited 40 years ago to launch his war on poverty?
Lyndon Johnson stood on the porch of a poor miner's cabin in Martin County Coal, where the unemployment rate was 70% then, and launched the war on poverty. And in 1964, the poverty rate in Appalachia was 31%. And 40 years after Lyndon Johnson's war on poverty, we have a lot more roads, we have a lot more indoor plumbing, but the poverty rate is still 31%.
Now, you observed this radical strip mining of Lost Mountain for a year. Is the mountain totally gone now?
It's totally gone. It's just a flat, lifeless plateau.
How high was it before the mining started?
It was about 1,900 feet, which by Western standards isn't much of a mountain at all. But it was an intact forested ecosystem. And one thing that should be pointed out is that Central Appalachia is the most biologically diverse ecosystem in North America. There are 70 species of trees in Central Appalachia. You won't find that anywhere else in the country. And that alone seems to be reason enough not to cause this kind of environmental destruction. And then the harm that it causes to the people of Appalachia as well only compounds the problem.
You say that when you were a child, you used to hike those forests and canoe the streams. Are most of them gone now?
They're either gone or they're too polluted to swim, or you could canoe them as long as you don't get out of your canoe.
Does the Appalachian forest still contain plants and trees and animals that aren't found elsewhere?
They do, but because this kind of mining causes what's known as forest fragmentations, there aren't large enough intact forests for a lot of species to exist. So 2/3 of the 250 songbirds on the Cumberland Plateau are in decline right now.
You say that the streams are being polluted, but also people's wells. How does that work? How does it get into the aquifer?
Because of the blasting. The blasting has just caused incredible damage to the aquifer. And I've talked to men who have dug a well, and in a week it was dry.
Mm-hmm. Do you actually find coal dust in these wells?
I don't know if you find coal dust in the wells. The coal dust covers the entire communities.
You visited a cemetery that contained the bodies of entire families who died young from cancer, but there's no way of ascertaining whether that's related to this, is there?
Well, I mean, if you look at studies that show how many heavy metals are in the water, I think there have been, I mean, I know there have been some studies that draw very strong connections between the drinking water and particularly problems that children have with blisters in their mouths, nausea, diarrhea, constant runny noses.
Won't this, is it slag, the refuse from the mountaintop, won't it eventually become something rich again, rich soil, as rain changes it and vegetation grows on it?
Do you mean the valley fills?
Yes.
Well, it takes 1,000 years to build an inch of topsoil because these mountains are so steep. So in 1,000 years, you might have some wildlife returning to the area.
The mountain that you followed, Lost Mountain, how tall was it again?
1,900 feet.
And now what is it?
About 1,500 feet.
So 400 feet have just been cut off. And was that rich in coal? Was it worth it?
It was rich in coal because there were four, though they were very thin seams of coal, about 4 to 10 feet thick. It was so easy to get to them using the blasting and the bulldozers and the front end loaders and the haul trucks that it was very economically efficient way of mining. I say in the book, I quote the Merle Travis song, 16 Tons, where the narrator of the song brags that he can load 16 tons of what's called number 9 coal. That's the number 9 coal seam in one day. And they were mining the number 9 coal seam on Lost Mountain. And a front-end loader can pick up 16 tons in about 5 minutes.
Mm. But it only goes about 400 feet. What happens below that? Does the coal stop, or is it just uneconomical to keep going?
They could go underground and get it. And, in fact, Lost Mountain was extensively underground mined in the 50s. So what's under there is pretty hollow now.
My guest is Eric Reese, who has written a book called Lost Mountain, A Year in the Vanishing Wilderness, Radical Strip Mining and the Devastation of Appalachia. It is published by Riverhead Books, and we will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Eric Reese. His book, Lost Mountain, A Year in the Vanishing Wilderness, Radical Strip Mining and the Devastation of Appalachia, is published by Riverhead Books. This began, as I said earlier, as an article in Harper's Magazine. What was the response to that article?
The main response I got was from people living pretty far from Appalachia in urban areas asking what they could do.
Do you think that people in the area, the affected area, know and perhaps see this industry as a kind of a trade-off? Because often when people try to step in and save old growth forests, for example, the locals say, no, you're going to take our jobs away from
right.
us.
Well, just like that, it's complicated because everybody in Appalachia has somebody in their family who works in the coal industry. So even if you think that this is a particularly odious way of strip mining, a lot of times you just keep it to yourself to make Sunday dinner go a little more smoothly.
One of the former mine sites was turned into a golf course. That's at Stumbo,
right.
Connecticut, a wonderful town name. Anyway, how many locals have the time and money to go out and play golf?
My friend, the novelist Silas House, who writes about Eastern Kentucky, says that nobody in his family has ever been to that golf course because they grew up poor and they just didn't grow up playing golf. So I think the only people that play golf there are members of the Kentucky legislature.
Did members of the Kentucky legislature respond to your article in Harper's?
No.
So you haven't really gotten much feedback from the people who can do something about the situation.
What has happened, one thing that's happened, is the great environmental writer Wendell Berry has organized a group of Kentucky writers who all got in planes and flew over this area to really see what it looks like from the air. Because unfortunately, when you're driving along the highway, you don't really see it because it's a mountaintop, so you have to see it from the air. And a lot of those people like Bobby Ann Mason and Silas House, have started using some of their influence as writers to put some pressure on some legislators in on Valentine's Day. There, a group of them are going to go to the legislature and present a sort of I Love Mountains campaign.
What about conservation groups like the Sierra Club? Have they gotten involved?
They have. They're working. The problem is sort of getting the attention of the mainstream media. It's kind of like the civil rights movement. Until you really see police beating old women with clubs, it's hard to get a lot of people's attention. And so last summer there was a group called Mountain Justice Summer who tried to use a lot of those tactics of creative civil disobedience to try to get the attention of people in urban areas, because the truth of the matter is people in Appalachia can't solve this problem. There's not enough of them. It has to be people coming from New York, from L.A., and participating.
Didn't you learn about the murder of a mine inspector while you were working on this story? Did that make it into the newspapers?
There was an article about his murder, but there was no follow-up.
Was his death found to be connected to his work?
Actually, it wasn't.
Uh-huh. So being a mine inspector isn't necessarily a dangerous job. What about being somebody, a journalist, who turns up all of this stuff? Did you ever worry?
I did worry. There are a lot of stories of people who go up to the mine sites and try to expose this, particularly documentary filmmakers who really come in for a lot of rough treatment.
Because they're trespassing on private property, aren't
they? Right. But even people like Larry Gibson, who's on his own property in West Virginia, but because his property happens to sit on about $500 million worth of coal, he's been run off the road. He's been shot at. Somebody hung both of his dogs. It's true that people aren't being gunned down in the streets of Matewan anymore, but the coal industry is still, there's still some pretty intimidating people in it.
Well, we're really talking about a huge area, aren't we? You say that there are now enough flattened mountaintops in eastern Kentucky to hold the cities of Louisville and Lexington.
500 square miles.
Wow. So I don't know how many acres that is, but 500 square miles is a large amount of land. Haven't they been able to do anything with this other than a golf course? What about industrial parks?
Yeah, the industrial park thing is interesting, because we have built a whole lot of industrial parks on these mine sites, and almost all of them sit empty. Industry does not want to come to eastern Kentucky because most industry doesn't follow coal. It's a dirty industry. It leaves the region dirty. It has left the people poor and undereducated. And it's the industries that do come are industries such as these computer call centers, who will get large subsidies to stay for 3 years. And as soon as those subsidies are up, they go to El Salvador.
That's what happened with Sykes.
That's what happened with Sykes Industry.
They moved some back office jobs into the coal field industrial park. And then when the tax incentives ran out, why El Salvador?
Because there's cheap labor in eastern Kentucky, but there's even cheaper labor in El Salvador.
How did you get interested in this story? I mean, this is an area that you've known all your life, but still, it's one thing. You teach writing. You're not an environmentalist.
Right. I think it came out of, as I said before, it came out of taking my students to Appalachia and spending some time in some very intact forests and hiking and riding and canoeing and really understanding the complexity, the redemptiveness of mixed mesophytic forest. And then driving from there up to a strip mine that surrounds that kind of forest to see that kind of contrast and to see that these forests that are beautiful and that you really care about are being threatened by this kind of mining, you realize that you can't just write about. I mean, I originally thought we would just be sort of a bunch of poets running around the woods writing nature poetry. But, I mean, we don't live in a time where you can do that. You know, you have to write about what's threatening those natural environments.
Now, when I read about these things in the newspapers, invariably a point is made that the land is often owned by the federal government, whether it's for coal or oil. Is that the case here? Who owns these mountains? mountains?
About 70% of the mountains are owned by coal companies, many of them outside the state.
You could just come in and say, I want to buy that mountain. Who do you buy it from?
Local people. A lot of them have owned these mountains and these mineral rights for decades. Some have owned them for centuries.
Are they leaving the area? Is the population declining in Appalachia?
It is. People are leaving, going, they like the Dwight Yoakam song, Reading, Writing, Route 23. You know, they're still taking Route 23 north out of Appalachia to look for better jobs. And the tragedy of that is, one of the things about Appalachia is it's a very tight group of families and communities. They're not people who want to leave. They're very connected to the place and to their families.
But if you don't have any water, if you can't breathe the air, that's an incentive to go.
There's no reason to stay.
In December 2004, you filed a citizen's complaint with the Federal Office of Surface Mining. What was that about?
I had a hunch that the blasting was taking place so close to the headwater streams that some of the groundwater was being affected. And I had already spent my month covertly exploring the mountain. And I just thought I would go ahead and blow my cover and let the industry and the regulators know that I was doing this. And it was really interesting because people who wouldn't return my calls a year earlier from the industry were suddenly happy to give me tours and, you know, show me what they wanted me to see.
And what did they want you to see? Obviously the positive side. What
right.
is the positive side?
The positive side, they claim, is that Appalachia needs flat land, that it's so mountainous that you got to have some place, after all, to put your Walmart. Of course, you could put 10,000 Walmarts on the flat land in Appalachia now, but they keep making this flat
land. Are there any Walmarts being put up there?
Yeah, they just put up a super Walmart in Hazard, but what happens is this land is so unstable after the mining that people can't. They've closed the Walmart because the floor is cracking.
Well, you, at the end of the book, propose planting new forests on the strip mine sites. Has anyone tried to do that?
There is something called the Appalachian Regional Reforestation Initiative, and every state has a representative of that. And it's slowly catching hold, but the problem is with coal miners or with surface miners, to ask them to do something different than just running a bulldozer over a mountaintop 100 times and flattening it, it just sounds to them like more regulation and more things they don't want to do. So I'm hoping that this reforestation initiative will catch on, because if we really had something like a New Deal for Appalachia where real money was put into reforestation, the unemployment rate could drop to zero overnight. You could have an entire generation working in forestry and wood industry.
What other employment opportunities are there in the area?
Walmart.
And coal mines.
And coal mines.
Now, when we talk about drilling for oil in Alaska in pristine areas or environmentally rich areas, people in Congress vote against it. How come if this area in Appalachia is the richest, you said the richest ecosystem in
right.
North America?
That's right.
How come that hasn't been an issue in this case?
I think it's because after the 60s, the United States pretty much turned its back on Appalachia. It remained extremely poor.
We had that moment with LBJ, and then we moved on when we realized some money had been earmarked for the area.
Right, right. The Appalachian Regional Commission earmarked some money, built a lot of roads, but really that no jobs followed those roads. So when you have a very remote region like Appalachia, you have poor people with schools that aren't very good, and you have a mainstream media that takes a lot of pleasure in ridiculing people from the Appalachia. Dukes of Hazzard, CBS wanted to do a reality show called The Real Beverly Hillbillies. So we still stereotype people from the mountains as ignorant hillbillies. So they're very easy to take advantage of.
And have other journalists come to you after they read the article in Harper's and said, we have to do something? Have environmental groups come to you?
They have, and I'm not the only person working on this. There have been a lot of other writers who have been writing a lot longer than I have about mountaintop removal, but it just seems like now, for some reason, it's getting some traction.
Well, we've seen the deaths of a number of miners recently in the old traditional mines that are made with tunnels, and this form of coal mining is environmentally destructive. Is there any way to safely get coal out that doesn't destroy things?
There was that case a couple days ago up in Canada where I think they rescued something like 64 miners from an underground mine because they had actually put the money into safety. And Australia has very good mining regulations as well. So I think there are some ways to increase the safety in underground mining, but you still face black lung. People should understand that to mine coal underground, sometimes you're working in a 2-foot-tall shaft. These miners work in awful, awful conditions to provide for their families. And I really think we need to think very seriously about alternative energy and conservation. If everybody listening to your show today went out and bought 5 compact fluorescent bulbs for their house, for the lights they use the most in their house, our dependence on coal would plunge overnight.
But if we continue to rely on coal, how do we make it safer? Is this a matter of the government really regulating an industry that doesn't want to be regulated?
Yes. If you look at Joe Manchin, the governor of West Virginia, he began pushing through real tough regulations where there would be tracking systems to track the miners underground. They would have much longer supplies of oxygen, more than 1 hour. I mean, he's pushing for a wholesale revision of mining rules. And I was just looking at the New York Times today. Richard Strickler, who it looks like is going to be the new head of Mine Safety and Health Administration, is quoted as saying, "I generally think the current laws are adequate." Well, that's ludicrous. They're not adequate. That's why we had 14 miners in West Virginia, and that's why Joe Manchin wants to overhaul the regulation of the...
What about some of the other effects of this approach to mining? What happens when it rains? Does it create landslides?
It creates incredible flash flooding and mudslides. 14 people have been killed in the last 3 years in West Virginia because there's simply no trees on these valley fills to hold back the mud. It comes down in waves. And in a town called McRoberts in eastern Kentucky, there were 3 so-called 100-year floods in 10 days there. I mean, this little community is literally being washed out of this hollow.
Mm-hmm. You spent a year there. Well, I'm sure you didn't spend every day of the year there. But was it depressing?
Yes, it was very depressing.
And did the people who lived there tell you that they were depressed, or did they just simply see this as the way life is?
There's a curious fatalism in Appalachia. Some sociologists connect it to the fact that there's such strong Baptist traditions there that sort of encourage this kind of fatalism. And if you combine that with the fact that the coal companies are so powerful, a lot of people have just come to the conclusion that it's too big a fight. They can't win it, that there's too many lawyers on the other side. Not everybody. There are obviously a lot of people fighting back.
What happened to your complaint? That was 2 years ago.
Well, they were supposed to respond to it in 10 days, and they responded to it finally in 11 months after I told them that I was about to publish the book and I hadn't heard from them. They did not find that there was any problem with the water.
So you said that there was that the groundwater was being polluted, and they tested it and said it wasn't?
Right. I'm not a hydrologist. I was just making a hunch. And their hydrologist said that it wasn't being polluted.
Eric Reese's article in Harper's, on which this book is based, won the Columbia University School of Journalism's 2005 John B. Oakes Award for Distinguished Environmental Journalism. He will be participating in a panel discussion on environmental journalism tonight at 7 o'clock at the Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism at 116th Street and Broadway. It's in the World Room. And the book is called Lost Mountain, A Year in the Vanishing Wilderness, Radical Strip Mining and the Devastation of Appalachia. It is published by Riverhead Books. I want to thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me. Until, you know, your listeners really become involved with this.
On tomorrow's show, we will pay tribute to the legacy of Johnny Cash with music writer Peter Guralnick and New York's own country singer Laura Cantrell. Then on Underreported, we'll explore the mixed economic effects of the Super Bowl. Will it give a boost to Detroit's depressed economy? What effect will it have on the national economy? The Leonard Lopez Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English and Brenna Farrell. We had help today from Barbara Kahn, Blake Neshek, Brian Levinson, and Virginia Doris. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopez, your host, and I'll see you tomorrow.